Welcome to the Aquarimax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 109, recorded April 18th, 2012. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Greetings from the land of the fishy.
First of all, we should apologize for the lateness of this episode.
Well, we might actually get it out on time. I'm going to try.
Oh, it is still Wednesday, isn't it?
Yeah, we're just recording it 2 days late.
I was thinking it was Thursday.
That's okay.
Okay, you don't get my apology unless it's late. Okay, today we're going to hear from Andreka in Oregon, David in Santa Clara, and Mick in Carnforth. So we are going to start off by listening to Andreka's message.
Hi, Russ and Kelly. This is Andreka in Oregon. I was just wondering if you guys had any thoughts about constipated fish. I have Gormies, Danios, and those are the ones that seem to be constipated. So anyways, I was wondering if I've been feeding them frozen hikari cubes, some dried betamins, and some algae wafers, and I once a week or so or less, I will feed them boiled, baked sweet potatoes, or today I did boiled carrots. I know that might be a little high on the sugary kind of thing, but I was wondering if you had any recommendations of what would kind of keep things moving along, you know, like do they need yogurt, or, you know, like is there like fishy acidophilus? I've been wondering about that. And also, I was listening to your show and you were talking about like how arowanas are kind of like ancient, you know, kind of, I don't know if it's prehistoric-ish kind of fish, but I was wondering if you had like the top, any suggestions like the top, maybe top 10 favorite prehistoric-ish fish, you know, that are popular in freshwater aquariums. So anyways, loving the show, and thanks for doing it.
Okay, well, thanks, Andreka, for sending that message. It has been a while since we'd had a voice message, and that's always fun. I like to hear people's voices. And
yes, it's always
like
nice.
That, so. Let's talk about, that is quite a message. It's got some good stuff in there. So first of all, fish constipation. Well,
poor fishies.
It's not too uncommon with pet fish to have constipation. The dry food diets that they get are quite a bit different from their wild diets. You know, the insect...
Kind of like we'd be constipated if all we ate was cold cereal.
Yeah, something like that. Because the insect and crustacean life that fish get in the wild contain a lot of chitin, which is good roughage.
It's like fiber?
Yeah, it is a kind of fibrous material. And that keeps their digestive tract pretty active. And many fish also eat... Yeah, algae, plant life, and so on, which does the same thing with the cellulose. But fish foods are often based on grains and fish meals and things like that, and they do have some roughage in them, but it's just not quite the same, is it? And the foods they eat in the wild are also full of moisture, and the foods that we give them...
Are dry,
although they absorb moisture pretty quickly once they hit the water, but still, it's a different thing. So, fish constipation is just, you know, something that does happen. But this is the interesting thing. The diet that you described in your message, like the frozen cubes and the veggies once a week or so, things like that, that doesn't sound like a diet that would lead to constipation.
Because usually if you're giving them veggies, especially if they're getting green stuff, you know, green beans or peas or lettuce or zucchini.
Right. Although in her message she mentions that she did sweet potatoes and carrots.
Sweet potatoes and carrots. And did she mention the greens?
I don't think she specifically said peas or greens.
Greens are usually helpful.
Yeah, and they are. So I would like to see what are in the cubes, because a lot of the cubes out there do contain greens. Like some mm-hmm. of them contain anacharis or peas or, you know, lettuce, different things like that. So I would be interested in hearing the ingredient list of the cubes, the frozen cubes that she uses. But really, the diet sounds pretty good.
It doesn't sound like she's just only feeding them dry food.
Right, exactly. It sounds like something that if you're feeding that to your fish, you could either cure or prevent constipation with it. So that's puzzling me somewhat. But that kind of leads us to the next thing. Let's talk about the symptoms that your fish are exhibiting. Because, you know, it could be something else. Maybe it's not constipation. Maybe it is. But let's talk about that a little bit. Are the fish showing signs of long stringy feces that remain attached to them? Is that what you're seeing? Because if you're seeing that, that is often, that is one of the symptoms of constipation, the main symptom, I would say, of constipation. The long stringy feces that trail behind the fish for a period of time.
It's got a string of poop.
Yeah, exactly.
Poor little fishy.
But if you're seeing something else, like maybe the fish are appearing bloated or something, this could also be something different. It could be a kidney failure. It could be tumors. It could be all kinds of things. Lots and lots of different things. So let's maybe from that we can determine which direction you need to go on this, and that can at least start to help.
Let's stop for a minute, too, for other people who do have the long stringy feces mm-hmm. attached to their fish still, whose fish are, we know for sure, constipated. What would you tell them to do?
Well, I would also suggest that Andreika try this, but I would try food like thawed but uncooked frozen peas mm-hmm. In small quantities and see how that does. Specifically, peas are often recommended for constipation. And while a lot of fresh food can help, that's one that's specifically indicated in a lot
that?
Of cases. I'm not sure, but it does have good roughage. It appeals to a lot of fish, even bettas.
They'll eat
will
them.
Typically, a lot of them will eat peas, not every one of them, but I've had plenty of bettas that will eat peas, which seems strange because it's a vegetable food, but for whatever reason, it's attractive to a lot of different fish. And it does contain the roughage that they need. And the way I do it is just pop them out of their skins.
So you get the two little halves of the pea.
Right. You don't want to give the fish the skin because most fish can't get through it when it's all around the pea. Some of the bigger fish can get through it, but a lot of them can't. And it seems to be easier for them to eat that way when you split it and more interesting for them, too. Live Daphnia is a great food item for constipation if you can get it.
Do
if you can't,
some of that chitin like you were talking
they
about?
They do. They contain a lot of chitin in their exoskeleton, so that helps. So they can be a natural laxative as well. Frozen Daphnia also work. And you can even get Daphnia that are preserved in various methods that aren't either one. There's some that come in a gel form, some that are in a form that once you open you need to refrigerate, but any of those could work, and they are good for constipation. So I would suggest those two things to start with. But let's go back a little bit to this situation with Andreika's situation. If there's zebra danios, the problem could be abdominal swelling for some other reason, too. And she did mention that danios were one of the fish that had the trouble. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the danios, the females just fill up with eggs. Sometimes danios develop tumors. That's not uncommon at all. For them to develop tumors.
They don't live that long, do they?
They're not a really, really
long,
live long, long-lived fish, sorry. They're not super long-lived, but they've been, you know, kind of inbred and so on to some extent, and a lot of them have that issue of some kind of tumor. A lot of times it's a benign tumor, but it...
still a tumor.
A lot of times it's a tumor, and things will go on like that. So there could be other things going on, too. Gouramis, as far as I know, and I could be wrong on this, but gouramis in general... maybe are not quite as prone to developing tumors as zebra danios are, but it can happen. I mean, just any fish can develop a tumor. But some of them are susceptible to bacterial infections like Mycobacterium, Piscine tuberculosis, which can sometimes manifest as a swollen abdomen. So if you are seeing bloating, then that's something else we need to look at. But hopefully that will help a little bit. Now, as far as the top 10 ancient aquarium fish...
That is a fun list.
Yeah, and I think we should do it. I don't think we should do it this week because I need to go through and you know, I want to find
make
out...
make it really spiffy.
Yeah, which fish, how many millions of years they've been around in their more or less unchanged form. Because off the top of my head, you know, I can list some fish that are pretty ancient, like bowfins and sturgeon and gar and lungfish, you know, mm-hmm. things like that. But which ones are the oldest and which ones are kept in aquariums? Because... I mean, people do occasionally keep sturgeon in an aquarium, but it doesn't really work out all that
kind
well.
Kind of if they're crazy.
Yeah. So, there are others, too. So, I think we should come back to that when I've had a chance to do a little bit of research on exactly how old and which ones are more popular in an aquarium and that sort of thing.
Okay,
but it is a great one.
Yeah. I was joking with Russ before the show that we should have our two sons on as guest speakers on ancient fish.
Because they are budding paleontologists.
They are indeed. Okay, let's go to our message from Mick. He's going to talk about some shrimp for us.
Indeed. See, what we've got is the message that Juliet sent, and we talked about Juliet's situation with the shrimp and the parasites and so on. We looked into that a bit more, and there are several parasites that are apparently causing the problem, just like Juliet said, and I wanted to be cautious before, but the evidence is mounting that that's really what's going on.
Well, it's kind of sad that she's got parasites, but it's good that she's been able to pinpoint the problem, because now she can take care of it.
Right.
And have happy fish.
And, you know, Mick sent a message in saying that he lost his shrimp, too, and then we talked about that in the last episode, mm-hmm. His sakura shrimps, specifically.
Which are the ones that she's having problems with.
That's the ones
with,
that yes. She's having problems with, and he says his, because I sent him an email saying, do you think that is the problem? Because he was wondering. Mm-hmm. And he said, yes, they were. He got an email from another shrimp keeper and had the same problem, and he's puzzled as we are why this particular strain has that issue, because apparently his other strains of the same species of shrimp are not affected. But we'll try to figure out what that is. He did give us some good information and some links from his shrimpy friend, and his friend said that he cured this issue.
How did
in
that?
A similar way to what Juliet did with the dewormer, the antiparasitic.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently there are a couple of different kinds of parasites that commonly affect the shrimp. One of them is vorticella or vorticella, maybe some people would say. And another one is something like scuriatella.
Okay.
And these are little worm-like creatures with little heads that sort of drill into the shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
And this friend of Mick said that Trimazole by Ceramed is shrimp safe, and he got it from eBay, and there's some links that talk about that, and we'll put
page.
Those on the page. And then he said if you have planaria or worms or hydra, this kind of thing, that are not on the shrimp but are other pests that can kill the shrimp, like hydra can kill baby shrimp, planaria seem to be sometimes maybe predators, or at least they compete for food with the shrimp or different things like that. If you have things like that, you can use that as well. This one's called Panicure, and that's I've heard of that used in marine aquaria to kill hydroids so that you can keep dwarf seahorses in a tank that has live rock in it, things like that. So it's apparently widely used in aquaria in certain situations. And he says that Panicure is shrimp safe if the dose is right, but there's another substance called No Planaria by Gen Chem. It's also shrimp safe, but his opinion is that it is not as effective to as a
as
treatment.
The other ones.
So I'm just reporting what he said. I can't say one or the other because I haven't tried them, but there are some good resources. We'll put those links up too. So thank you to Mick and to Mick's friend.
Indeed.
For sending those. Hopefully we'll get that working. And we are working out a way to get an interview with Mick on mouth brooding betas. That's going to be so cool. We
that
just need to
neat.
Figure out when we can do it. That's the hard time.
Darn
hard
time
part.
Zones.
But we'll get it working.
You
all
don't
right.
need to sleep, right? Nobody needs to sleep.
There you go.
Sleep is overrated. Okay, we are going to go to David's message now. He's in Santa Clara, California. And David is a new contributor.
Yeah, so welcome, David. Thank you for joining us in terms of both listening and contributing.
And he says, I've been listening off and on since nearly the beginning and have enjoyed all of the podcasts, though I felt the need to make a correction with the last one. The Great Lakes of East Africa are old, at least two of the three. Lake Tanganyika is believed to be 9 to 12 million years old. There are approximately 200 species of cichlid from Tanganyika. Lake Malawi, 5 to 7 million years, with more than 800 species, though it may have dried up as recently as 570,000 years ago. Speciation in both Tanganyika and Malawi often occurred from lake level changes, causing species to be fractured. Average speciation took 1,000 to 17,000 years in time. Lake Victoria, being the youngest, at approximately 15,000 years. That's how old the lake is? Is that what he means?
Well, yes, that is what he means.
The cichlid lineage from Lake Victoria is approximately 100,000 years of age and originated from the lakes around Victoria. Cichlids range from as far east as the Chromides in India to convicts in Central America. It is believed, from what I recall, that the common ancestor is from Madagascar and radiated out from there while Pangaea was still intact. Lastly, there are also a number of different cichlids that are saltwater tolerant from around the globe, which could allow for further speciation. Chromides?
Chromides, uh-huh.
Chromides Etropolus surutensis, black belts, vieja?
That looks like the Spanish vieja.
Looks like Spanish, yeah. Mm-hmm. It should be Latin, but... Maculicauda, Cuban cichlid, Nadopsis tetracanthus, and the like.
Okay, well, David, thank you for setting the record straight there. I think
what
I probably
said? I honestly don't remember exactly
what I'd said, but I'm sure I muddled some of the details because it had been a while since I had read about this, a long time, in fact. Because I did read a book, which I think was called The Cichlid Fishes, and focused on the Rift Lakes a lot. But that has been so many years that I probably just made a kind of a hash of some of the details as I was trying to explain it. So I'm glad that you set the record straight there. I guess in terms of geologic time, too, saying recent is kind of a dumb thing of me to have said. Because recent,
recent
can mean so many different things.
570,000 years ago is recent in geologic time.
Well, Pangaea, you know...
Well, I mean, if you're talking about, you know, when it's may have dried up as recently as 570,000 years
right.
ago.
Right. Well, yeah. And the supercontinent of Pangaea was still splitting up. It was it formed, I think, around 300 million years ago, started splitting up around 200 million years ago, and was pretty much all in pieces close to what we see now, something like 40
million years
ago? I mean, it was gradually breaking up during that time from about 200 million until about 40 million or something like that.
Okay.
So
we can ask Isaac.
According to that,
he would know.
You know, it's less, these are pretty recent, but they're still a lot older than I was thinking. And I think part of the reason is because with these lake level changes and the drying up and so on, I guess I kind of muddled it up. But there you go. So thank you, David, for fixing that for us and explaining that. He also put some really good links here. There's one from the Cichlid Forum and different things like that. So we'll put those on the page so you can check those out.
Great.
And get some more information on cichlids and like the lakes, rift lakes and so on, because it's a fascinating study. There's all sorts of interesting things you can learn from that.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Piscean Eye.
You know, I did look up arowanas, by the way, because we were talking about different fish and how they exist on different continents. Not only do they exist in South America and Asia, which is what I had mentioned, but I guess in Africa and Australia as well. So that's kind of
fun. They're all over the place.
Yeah, there are lots of fish that are all over the place. So one thing that I wanted to mention, too, a couple of things. I know I keep mentioning something about Daphnia, but I'm doing an experiment where I've got two Daphnia buckets outside now, and they are reproducing, as I mentioned before, one of them with aeration and one without. And I want to see how that affects the reproduction. And of course, my hypothesis is that the tank with aeration will get a lot more reproduction going on for various reasons.
When did you start that?
A couple of days ago.
So it's too early to really tell.
Yeah, the Daphnia and that one haven't had a chance to reproduce yet. The other one, the original adults are still in there, but there's also a couple of different broods that have been released. So they're reproducing, but still fairly slowly.
Now, you had mentioned before you were putting in protein powder in their food, and you weren't sure yet if it was making a difference.
Yeah, but I think
but
it
now
has.
now you're sure.
Yeah. I've noticed a boom in population in the jars that I've been keeping in the house. The only variable that's really changed, well, I can't really say that, but the only intentionally changed variable has been the food. Where I've been feeding both spirulina and the pea-based protein powder, PEAP-based protein powder, is the only variable I've changed on purpose, and their reproduction has increased. Now, temperature has been changing, something we can't really control.
It's getting warmer.
It's getting warmer. Photo period is probably changing because mm-hmm. they're close to a window. So those are some possible extraneous variables. But something's working, and they're
which
going nuts.
Good.
Which is great, because I'm getting a lot more Daphnia in those jars. And so I'm looking forward to seeing how that works. Now, I'd like to mention another, I guess you could call this experiment, although I've done similar things in the past. I've had a bit of a problem with duckweed lately, because whenever I get duckweed...
Duckweed, foul duckweed.
Yeah, it can be foul, and that's kind
it's
of a
pretty.
Good joke.
It's pretty, there's
like
just
that.
Too
no
much
intended,
of it.
Huh?
Oh, see, it foul wasn't duckweed. Intended, I didn't even do that on purpose.
So, duckweed is kind of interesting, and it can be useful, because goldfish love it and things like that. So whenever I see a little duckweed that comes home from the pet store with me, I think, oh, I'll just let it grow this time, and it'll be okay, and I'll use it, and it'll be great. And then it starts getting stuck in the filter, and I say, why did I think that this time? I know that I don't really like to have duckweed around for that reason. So I did an experiment, which is a little bit risky, but what I did, I got a couple of small goldfish, and I put them in some of the tanks that have the duckweed in them. And how long ago did we get the goldfish? It was
maybe a week?
I think it might be a little longer. Because that's when we went over to the bonfire.
It was Easter. It was the weekend of Easter.
It was Saturday, yeah. Saturday before Easter. So, yeah, anyway, we put some wee little goldfish in the tanks. Not feeder goldfish, because that would have been catastrophic, possibly. But we put some
little
fantails. Yeah. And one in a 10-gallon, one in a 20, and one in a 55. All that had some duckweed issues to varying degrees. The 20-gallon now has no sign of duckweed in it at all. And we have a chubby little goldfish. The 10-gallon took a little longer, but...
Now, why did the 10-gallon take longer? Because it seems like it would have less.
You would think so, but it may be the particular taste of that goldfish or whatever. Because goldfish sometimes take a while to realize that they like duckweed. And now that tank has very little evidence of duckweed remaining. And then the 55 has more duckweed, but it's a bigger tank, and there's more duckweed in it. But the goldfish does seem to have... begun
He's
to
working
eat it.
On it.
So I'm interested to see how this plays out, but it seems like it's going to be working. And these three goldfish, once they're finished taking care of the duckweed, will all go into a 55 and
be happy goldfish.
Be happy goldfish. Three goldfish in a 55 with some bristlenoses. That's not too bad. Because bristlenoses are one of the few species I'll keep with goldfish.
Mm-hmm.
So
they don't bug each other so much.
Do you want to hear my thought experiment too?
Tell me your thought experiment. Okay.
My thought experiment is this. You remember we talked to Brian a while ago about refugia in freshwater tanks?
Okay.
Okay, and refugium or refugium, depending on how you prefer to pronounce it, is basically a small tank that is either inside or attached to your main tank. And they're very common in saltwater tanks. And actually, they're... a couple of different purposes that they can serve, but the name refugium comes from the idea that this small tank is a place where organisms that are beneficial to the ecosystem can grow in a protected environment, and then they can be introduced back into the normal tank just through the flow of water,
mm-hmm.
because the water will flow into the refugium, then back out into the main tank, and that flow will carry the little... creatures that are reproduced in the refugium back into the main tank where they can be eaten by the organisms that live there. But if you don't have a refugium, then they don't have a place to reproduce.
And so they eat them all and then there's none left.
So either they're all eaten or so many of them are eaten that you don't produce as many.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the idea. And of course, refugia can be used for filtration and all kinds of things as well. But the name comes from that idea. And that's, like, I guess you could say the true refugium is this place where the organisms grow.
Okay.
At any rate, I was thinking what would be really interesting to do, because I've noticed that African dwarf frogs love amphipods, also known as scuds or gammarus, things like that. They really love them. It would be very interesting to create a tank with a divider in it, maybe along the back or something, so it looks like a false wall.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like a wall, but it's a false wall, where you have a refugium back there, where you've created an environment where amphipods could thrive. And then... you keep the African dwarf frogs in the part out in the front,
mm-hmm.
and see if you can actually maintain a population of amphipods that will continue to feed the frogs. I'm curious as to whether or not you could do that.
African dwarf frogs at work, do you not?
Yes, I do.
Are you contemplating actually carrying this out then?
Well, yeah. Right now it's a thought experiment, but I do have that 4.5 tank that has the partitions in it.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking what I could do is set that tank up and put a partition in and keep amphipod cultures, actually fishless cycle, you know, first.
Mm-hmm.
And put a lot of surface area in a small partition and seed it with amphipods once the fishless cycle is completed, and then make sure they're reproducing like mad, and then introduce the frogs, but keep that partition there,
mm-hmm.
so that the amphipods can reproduce but also make their way out to where the frogs are, because the partitions aren't complete. They could slip around the little edges of the glass, but I don't think the frogs could.
Mm-hmm.
That would be cool to see if that worked.
That would be neat.
So that's my little thought experiment I'd like to share, and if anybody else gives it a try, let me know how it goes. Because I think there's some room for things like that in freshwater tanks. We don't usually do it. People do it in saltwater tanks all the time. You know, refugia, where they allow amphipods and copepods to breed. And then they go into the main tank. And not even that. I mean, they'll do other things, too. They'll have shrimp that breed in there. And then their larvae get carried out into the main tank. And they eat the larvae, you know, the fish in the main tank and stuff. So all kinds of things. And it would be really interesting to see how that pans out. So maybe if I do it, I will... I'll take a photo.
You should document it.
Right. If I end up doing it, I will. I might be able to tie it into something I do at work, one of my projects at work, and then I could sort of have a dual purpose thing going on. So we'll
see. That'd
be good. All right. Well, I think that's about it for this week. Is it not?
I think so.
So, thank you for joining us once again, and may
the fish
be
with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.